listen.
History Month 2015, the Black Lives Matter movement forces us to examine the long history of physical and economic violence by the state against African Americans. A conversation for this month's installment of The F Word with veteran activists and educators Rosemary Mealy and Sam Anderson. Also, Venezuelans commemorate the one-year anniversary of the orchestrated violence and destabilization within their country. All of that and more is coming up next. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for February 19th, 2015. I'm Esther Averam.
And I'm Lucy Murphy.
A shout-out to Dave Zirin and Eitan Thomas for their success during our Winter Fun Drive before us. And thank you for staying tuned for a little belated edition of On the Ground this morning, which, you know, is always jam-packed full of news and ideas, and we dare say some inspiration we can all use to keep fighting the good fight. And to support this type of programming that you can only get on your listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio right here in the nation's capital, you can get us started on our third show for the Winter Fun Drive by calling 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or pledge right online at
www.wpfwfm.org.
Well, you know, we had a tremendous response to our first installment of the F Word last month. This is our new segment every third Thursday of the month that we're dedicating to a discussion of the ways that we do and do not live with fascism in the United States. The convergence of increased corporate control of the state through rulings such as Citizens United, combined with a culture of violence and impunity for the military and law enforcement, only reinforces for some of us on the left that there's what we commonly call creeping fascism. This month's conversation today will be with veteran activists and educators Rosemary Mealy and Sam Anderson. Also, Venezuelans commemorate the one-year anniversary of the orchestrated violence and destabilization within their country. All that is coming up, but first our headlines.
Tens of thousands gathered in the North Carolina capital of Raleigh on Saturday for what organizers are calling one of the largest civil rights rallies in the South since the Selma to Montgomery March in 1965. The Mass Moral March is held annually to fight moves by Republican lawmakers to attack voting rights, education, the environment, health care, and women's rights. North Carolina Republicans control the governorship and both houses of the state legislature. It was the ninth Mass Moral March led by state NAACP President, the Reverend William Barber.
When extremist politicians underfund public education and create anorexic, high poverty, resegregated schools, and then create anorexic teacher salaries, and then produce anorexic student performance and educational development, we have a heart problem.
The rally also featured two brothers who have lost siblings speaking side by side. Faris Barakat, brother of Dia Barakat, one of three Muslim students killed in Chapel Hill last week in what family members call a hate crime, and Pierre Lacy, brother of Lennon Lacy, the African-American teenager who was found hung to death under suspicious circumstances last year in Bladensboro, North Carolina. This week also marked the first official Moral Monday protest of the year and included a people's court to indict right-wing lawmakers for pursuing policies that have hurt the people of the state. Also in the South, three white men have been sentenced to prison for the 2011 murder of an African-American man in Jackson, Mississippi. The three and other friends beat James Craig Anderson, a 49-year-old black auto plant worker, while yelling white power and other racial epithets. Surveillance footage then shows one of the individuals' truck driving over Anderson, killing him instantly. Daryl Paul Dedman received 50 years in prison, John Aaron Rice, 18 and a half years, and Dylan Wade Butler, 7 years. All were convicted of the commission of a hate crime. And Amnesty International has renewed its call for Louisiana to release the longest-serving U.S. prisoner in solitary confinement. Former Black Panther Albert Woodfox's conviction has been overturned 3 times, and in November, an appeals court upheld the latest court order for his release. But last week, a Louisiana grand jury reindicted Woodfox for the 1972 murder of a prison guard. He and the late Herman Wallace, another member of the Angola Three, said they were framed for their political activism. In a statement, Amnesty International called for Louisiana Attorney General Buddy Caldwell to stop pursuing a campaign of vengeance by trying to reindict a man who has already spent more than 4 decades in cruel confinement after a legal process tainted with flaws. Woodfox turned 68 today. In Detroit, a federal judge has rejected a bid for a new trial from a Palestinian activist convicted of immigration fraud. Rasmia Odeh was found guilty of concealing her conviction on bombing charges by an Israeli military court more than 40 years ago. She says her confession to the bombings was obtained through torture and sexual assault in Israeli custody. Supporters say she was targeted by U.S. authorities because of her prominent support for Palestinian liberation. She faces up to 10 years in prison and deportation at her sentencing next month. In other Israel news, the Israeli Supreme Court has rejected an appeal from the family of Rachel Corrie, the U.S. activist crushed to death by an Israeli army bulldozer in nearly 12 years ago, as she tried to protect a Palestinian home from demolition. Corrie's parents had sued the Israeli Ministry of Defense for a symbolic $1 in damages, but a lower court cleared the military of responsibility, saying Corrie's death had taken place in a war zone. Last week, the Supreme Court upheld that decision. The Corrie family said in a statement, "We had hoped for a different outcome, though we have come to see through this experience how deeply all of Israel's institutions are implicated in the impunity enjoyed by the Israeli military." Speaking of impunity, Spanish activists and local housing advocates gathered at the headquarters of the private equity firm Blackstone Group in New York City to protest its treatment of tenants around the world. Following the global financial crisis, Blackstone has been at the forefront of Wall Street's takeover of the housing market. In Spain, Blackstone was swept up nearly 42,000 rental and mortgaged units. Critics in Spain and in the U.S. accused the company of harassing tenants and driving up rents in an effort to force people out of their homes. Pablo Laparra of the group Marea Granite, New York City, described the problem in Spain, where the unemployment rate is 25%.
The problem right now is that many banks that were rescued with public funds are selling their mortgages to private vulture funds as Blackstone. Many people is facing eviction because Blackstone's strategy is to raise the prices for the tenants so people is no longer able to pay the rent. So they leave the apartment and then Blackstone can renegotiate the prices. So they are earning money with people suffering.
In the United States, Blackstone has become the largest owner of single-family rental homes in the country. Over the last few years, Blackstone and other Wall Street firms have been quietly grabbing up huge swaths of the rental housing market, purchasing more than 200,000 cheap homes, hoping to turn a profit. At one auction in Atlanta, Blackstone swept up 1,400 houses in a single day. Here in D.C., activists are alerting consumers about another type of consumer danger just as close to home, your community dollar store. According to a new report by the Campaign for Healthier Solutions, dollar store products are more likely to be contaminated by hazardous chemicals. Specifically, at least 71% of the products tested from each dollar store chain contained one or more hazardous chemicals above levels of concern. The report, entitled A Day Late and a Dollar Short, points out that many areas served by dollar stores are communities of color or low-income communities that are already disproportionately exposed to chemical hazards and health effects linked to chemical exposures. Also here in D.C. this weekend, three newsworthy events. The National Black United Front is hosting the Malcolm X Black Power Conference, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, starting tomorrow, February 20th, through Sunday, February 22nd, at the Blackburn Center on Howard University's campus. This conference, one of several events being held around the country to mark the anniversary of Malcolm X's death, begins at 6 p.m. tomorrow and with the panel, Malcolm X and the Political Philosophy of Black Nationalism. For more information, go to the website for the National Black United Front, nbuf.org. Also scheduled at Howard University's Blackburn Center tomorrow and Saturday is the Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Association Conference. The Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Alliance is holding this event to bridge gaps between members of its community who reside in rural and urban cities. It hopes to keep front and center the issues of farming and the African American community. Mike Stewart, an organizer of the conference, said that conference topics will include the significance of land ownership, discrimination and its impact on the health and well-being of farmers and their families, and agriculturalist sustainability and access to healthy foods for all.
We're trying to bring awareness of whole foods and healthy foods back to the foreground, and we're trying to also beef up the ideal of small-scale farming, not just in the rural environment, but also in the urban environment, where we can actually have food that is healthy, that is nutritious, and that's organic.
And finally, in our culture and media moment, the producers of this Sunday's broadcast of the Academy Awards fears dip in black viewership after the controversial omission of black actors from nomination. Some organizations are urging a boycott or blackout of the Oscars broadcast. Teachers and Twitter users are slamming an educational video game that places students in the shoes of a U.S. slave before the country's Civil War. In the role-playing game, students assume the character of Lucy, a 14-year-old slave on a Kentucky plantation. Players make choices for Lucy as they attempt to navigate her escape from slavery. After receiving an email recommending Mission U.S. for Black History Month, educator Rafrance Davis voiced her concerns over turning the experience of slavery into a game. If you want to create a role-playing game about history, fine, do it. But choose moments in history that are not about the rape, beating, degradation, mutilation, and murder of a people, Davis said. And locally, in our culture and media moment, artists and arts organizations are invited to a meeting this Saturday at 10 a.m. to get information about the $10 million that is earmarked for streetscape, including art, along Rhode Island Avenue. The Rhode Island Avenue Task Force meeting will be held this Saturday, February 21st, from 10 a.m. to noon at the Rhode Island Row Community Room, 2300 Washington Place Northeast, adjacent to Rhode Island Avenue Metro. RSVP at pcdcward5@gmail.com or call 202-540-0247 or 202-491-9245. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, Venezuelans and their supporters commemorate and offer a different take on the violence that rocked their country 1 year ago. We'll be right back.
Well, 1 year ago, the world's corporate media filled screens and pages with news about violence perpetrated by the Venezuelan government against peaceful protesters. But in a few places, like here on Pacifica, another story emerged about well-financed and violent protesters waging a highly orchestrated and destructive campaign that destroyed public infrastructure, targeted civil servants, and attempted an unconstitutional regime change. On Friday, On the Ground attended a program at the Venezuelan embassy here in D.C. to commemorate the dozens of lives lost during these violent protests known as guarimbas. The program included testimony by those who lost loved ones during the violence, statements of solidarity by those from other Latin American countries that have faced destabilization efforts. And this next piece, we'll have to just play a piece of it. I wanted to play the whole thing, but maybe later next week or after. This piece is called What is Really Happening in Venezuela by the Hands Off Venezuela Coalition. And it was also one of the presentations. And before I play the audio from this video, let me remind you that we are in our winter fund drive, and you should call 202-588-9739 to pledge your support for On the Ground and for WPFW, your listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. Where else can you hear The Collision? Where else can you hear On the Ground? Where else can you hear Democracy Now? And we know we play a vital part to not only the radio life and what you can hear in this city, but also to the democracy, to also the people being informed so they can make informed choices. So 202-588-9739 is the number to call. 202-588-9739. If you're listening online, you can pledge right on the website. Just click the donate button and pull down the menu to the Thursday's edition of Community Watch and Comment. So let's hear a little bit of this piece, What's Really Happening in Venezuela.
What's really going on in Venezuela? On January the 23rd, Leopoldo López and Maria Corina Machado publicly declared their intention to oust President Nicolas Maduro and his government. They called the plan La Salida, the exit.
Porque lo siguiente es prender las calles de lucha cívica y responsable. Vamos a prender las calles de Venezuela, todos los rincones, los mercados, las escuelas, las universidades, las plazas.
Over the following days, these two opposition leaders and their political party, Voluntad Popular, Popular Will, held public meetings in the main cities around the country. Their slogan was, "It's time to talk about a change of government." On the 2nd of February, in a public demonstration in Caracas, they activated the ousting by calling on people to take to the streets of Venezuela.
Aquí el problema, hermanas y hermanos, ya no podemos decir que solamente es Nicolás Maduro, no. Aquí el problema son todos los poderes públicos del poder nacional. La calle, 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 salgamos a la calle.
On the 6th of February, groups of students, mainly from Los Andes University, attacked the house of the governor of Táchira State. 6 policemen were injured and 12 students were arrested during the violent scenes. The students were freed on the 13th of February and ordered to report to court every 8 days. Following their arrests, violent acts became commonplace in Táchira State and other states of the Venezuelan Andes region. On the 7th of February, just 1 day after the violence in Táchira, Leopoldo López called for massive demonstrations to take place across Venezuela and especially in Caracas. The day selected was the 12th of February, Venezuela's National Youth Day. Whilst thousands of students and young people marched to support the government, opposition protesters destroyed private and public property in Caracas and other cities. 3 people were killed during the violence that day, 2 students and 1 government supporter. This is what's really going on in Venezuela. An extremist minority of violent opposition members have blocked roads, attacked public and private buildings, and set fire to police cars. Looting has also been reported.
Hey If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, and you just heard audio from the video, What is Really Happening in Venezuela. It was produced last year, but is fitting to mark the anniversary of the orchestrated violence that attempted an unconstitutional regime change in that country. You know, you were there with me last Friday, and it was really quite an event, very emotional. I was struck by the solidarity of the people who were there to support the people of Venezuela.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so we are here in our installment for this month of our segment, The F Word, and I'm Esther Varum.
And I'm Lucy Murphy.
So we had a tremendous response to our first installment of The F Word. This is our new segment every third Thursday of the month that we are dedicating to a discussion of the ways that we in the U.S. do and do not live with fascism, the convergence of increased corporate control of the state through rulings such as Citizens United, combined with a culture of violence and impunity for the military and law enforcement, only reinforces for some of us on the left that of what is commonly referred to as creeping fascism, or we don't know if it's really creeping so much. And so this month's conversation today will be with veteran activists and educators Rosemary Mealy and Sam Anderson. Rosemary Mealy is an adjunct assistant professor at the City College of New York Center for Worker Education. Professor Mealy, who holds a law degree and a PhD, has been honored for her community involvement on numerous occasions and was the recipient of the prestigious Claudia Jones Fellow in the African New World Studies program at Florida International University. She's lived and worked in Cuba, where she's collaborated on several projects in support of U.S. political prisoners with Assata Shakur. She previously served as the UN NGO rep for the National Alliance of Third World Journalists. She's also a former radio producer at WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York, our sister station, and has worked in and with numerous women of color and labor organizations. Her work also spans being an activist in an international human rights and political prisoner movement. She's the author of two books, including Fidel and Malcolm X, Memories of a Meeting, now out in a second edition from Black Classic Press. Welcome to On the Ground, Rosemary.
Oh, good morning, Esther. Thank you so much for inviting us.
And also on the line is Sam Anderson, also known as S.C. Anderson in literary circles. He's an author, longtime activist, and educator, and he was one of the founding members of the Black Panther Party, as well as an activist within the SNCC Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Black Arts Movement. Also, he has been an activist since the 1960s when various organizations and struggles. He was also a founding member of the Black Student Congress, African Heritage Studies Association, the African Liberation Support Committee, the Black New York Action Committee, Black Liberation Press, the New York Algebra Project, and he's the author of several books, including The Black Holocaust for Beginners. Welcome, Sam.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. It's still morning. So I'll address these questions to both of you. And before I do that, I'm reminded by the program director and the folks upstairs to give the pledge line 202-588-9739 to support WPFW and On the Ground, your Jazz and Justice station here in the nation's capital. But I want to address both of these questions to you. I initially wanted to have you talk about the Black Lives Matter movement last month, and I'm so happy you were able to be with me today. So to start with, the Black Lives Matter movement forces us to examine the long history of physical and economic violence by the state against African Americans. And so the convergence of this increased corporate control of the state through rulings such as Citizens United, combined with a culture of violence and impunity for the military and law enforcement, only reinforces for some of us on the left that there is this, you know, that we're living increasingly in a fascist state. So what do you think about that? Are those issues connected for you?
Oh, yeah, they definitely are connected, connected for at least 150 years of connection in terms of the evolution of capitalism in the United States post the slavery era. Absolutely.
Did you want to add something, Rosemary?
Well, yeah, I just think that it's good that you're having this discussion, because a lot of times we embrace these political issues and they almost emerge as fantasies without us really defining the ideological constructs. And so I think in the discussion around fascism or whether we're living in a fascist cure it or prefaces or post or what have you. Clearly not post, but to look at it in the context of how do you define fascism? Not, you know, because usually a lot of times when people think about fascism, our minds or our memories revert back to Germany, and we think of it in the context of what happened to the Jewish people, the concentration camps, without really having any analysis of what were the economic relationships that emerged during that period that it would rise to the point of exterminating individuals and denying people human rights. So I think it's important that we unmask any kind of misperceptions or concepts about what it is, and let's, you know, lay the framework. So I think this is a good way to do it, and you're doing a good job.
So in terms of that framework, we talked last month when we had Gerald Horn on, we gave the definition given by George Jackson, and, you know, he talked about the, you know, complete control of the state by monopoly capital. And he said that fascism is the last stage of capitalism in the heart of the U.S. imperial center, where the relationship between the state and corporation becomes indiscernible. So using that definition, a lot of people say, you know, well, that's where we're living, and that's how we're living. So, you know, I mean, what do you think about that? Is it a pre-fascist state, or how do you perceive it? How do you look at it?
It's a pre-fascist state. If it was a fascist state, you wouldn't have the radio program.
That's what Gerald said.
Okay. So it's you know, we're creeping up to being a completely fascist state where media is absolutely controlled and defined by the 1%, the corporate powers that be, where education is absolutely controlled, or no education is absolutely controlled by the powers that be. By no education, I mean where people have to, if you don't have the money to get to get your child in school, then your child will not be educated. That's a growing reality in the United States, with the privatization moves within public education that includes the charter school movement. That is very, very dangerous, extremely dangerous. And on the cultural front, the control by, for example, the hip hop cultural genre is now dominated and controlled by the corporate powers. Even though there are progressive hip hop workers, cultural workers around, they get minimal play. In spite of the access to the internet and so forth, they get minimal play. What dominates in terms of youth culture right now is the corporate culture defining what youth culture is.
Wow.
And also, I think, you know, we have to look at the role of the legal system. We have to look at the role of how the legal system then becomes a kind of like a pipeline to advance this privatization process. And I think when we talk about the prison industrial complex, that's a classic example of this creep, what we're talking about, how social services become privatized. And people, you know, our demands in the street are always for the saving of social service programs, to ensure that we have a safety net for poor people, for working people. And that safety net does not exist because it does not increase the corporate roles of the shareholders. And so, you know, I think we have to put that within the framework of what we're talking about.
All right. I am going to just stop and pitch a little bit here, just interrupt our conversation a little, because I don't see our figure moving Lucy. And, you know, before we came on, Mike played the Malcolm, one of the Malcolm X speeches, and that's one of the gifts that are available still during this hour. And so there's the Malcolm X collection on MP3, and it's 10 hours of his speeches on an MP3 CD. And there's also the gifts that we mentioned earlier. We have Citizen Coke, the DVD that talks about the Coke brothers. We have, and basically how they have managed to take over so much of financing government, you know, determining the outcome of elections, and really that's how you control the state, by controlling elected officials. So 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739, or you can pledge online at WPFW.org. You can also, when you call, the operator can tell you all the gifts that you can get, the thank you gifts, if you would like one. But we do want you to call 202-588-9739. So, Rosemary and Sam, in the same vein, I know both of you as longtime residents of New York City are very familiar with Rudy Giuliani. You know, and I thought his comments when this country was so focused on Ferguson were very telling and disturbing to me. You know, I watched him in a television interview, and he not only declared the police officer Darren Wilson justified in the killing of this unarmed teenager, but he also said all the witnesses who saw Michael Brown with his hands up as he was being shot down should also be charged with perjury. You know, and I kind of thought, oh my God, how Orwellian. And of course, he made these comments, I think, on Fox News or some other kind of right wing, you know, media outlet. So you touched earlier on how the media is a part of this equation. But I also wanted you to talk about how people like Rudy Giuliani, who are increasingly ascendant in the Republican Party, fit into this discussion.
Well, you know, good. I'm speaking from experience. Giuliani was the toughest, you know, he ran on a platform of racism, number one, and being tough on crime. And those of us who lived during the Giuliani era here in New York, we were not surprised by the comments that he made, because I know that Pacifica did a lot of work emerging out of New York into all the other stations around the country and reporting about when Abner Lima in 1997 was sodomized, and then there was the killing of Amadou Diallo, where that brother was shot 41 times in the hallway of a building in 1999. And throughout that whole time, Giuliani, he maintained his defense of the police and his opposition to any kind of reform of the New York Police Department. So his tough on crime policies were supposedly critical to bringing down the crime statistics in the city, but those crime statistics before he took office, and when Jenkins was in mayor was the mayor, we saw, and so he brought this ideological point of view into the politics of the city with his support of Wall Street, and so it doesn't surprise us that he would need, that now he's being accepted, or that he's chosen a national platform to sprout his ideological views. And so, like I said, when we heard that, it was just a continuation of his leadership here in New York City.
202-588-9739. I want to thank Clyde from Washington, D.C. He's going to pick up the Malcolm X collection on MP3. Thank you, thank you, thank you so much, Clyde. And I want other lists, I know you're out there, you're listening, you're enjoying the discussion. I want you to join Clyde. Where's Maryland? Where's Virginia? Arlington, Fairfax, all those folks out in Upper Marlboro, Bowie, I need Silver Spring, that's right near me. I need to hear from you. We need to make our goal. We made our goal 2 weeks in a row when others have not, and I've been really proud of that. So I want to keep up the momentum, and definitely, you know, this discussion is worth it. So, you know, did you want to add to that, Sam?
Yeah, just for people not familiar with the Giuliani regime, before he took office, the year before he took office, 720 people were arrested for a misdemeanor marijuana-related offenses. By 2000, when he left, right, the number had jumped to 59,495.
Wow.
During a 10-month period in 1996, 50,000 people were detained on misdemeanors and were strip searched by the Department of Corrections.
Wow. Well, you know, we had a little technical difficulties this morning, and I intended our segment to be a lot longer. So promise me that you'll come back next month. Promise me you'll come back next month, because we have, you know, I had a lot more questions to ask you. But I need to, you know, ask our listeners to support WPFW and On the Ground today by calling 202-588-9739. We can offer you the Citizen Coke DVD about the Koch brothers. We still have a copy of Gerald Horn, Counter Revolution. Also, Gerald Horn's Race the Revolution for a pledge. And again, the Malcolm X collection on MP3. That'll have to do it for us. On Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition, I'm Esther Varum.
And I'm Lucy Murphy.
And special thanks to both of our guests, who are both authors, educators, and activists, Rosemary Mealy and Sam Anderson. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening and calling in. Remember to write the D.C. Public Service Commission now. Let them know you don't want Exelon, a nuclear power giant, to operate our electrical utility here in the district. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and our past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. We continue our winter drive, fun drive next week. Stand by On the Ground. You can keep calling 202-588-9739. And it will still count toward our goal to the top of the hour. Raise your voice. Peace.